Hello everyone, Joshua Gilliland here, one of the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks. With me is Steve Chu, and we're here to talk about Star Trek Picard Episode 3, The End is the Beginning. Steve, how you doing?
Great. Always happy to talk Star Trek. Loving the show.
Absolutely. It is nice to have weekly Trek again, and that fits the message of Trek.
Yes.
Even though we do have a few things that are new to Trek, thanks to being on CBS All Access that they didn't do in other times.
Yeah. And I'll say that I don't know how long I can keep this up, just due to everything else that's always going on in life. But for the first three episodes, I have, for whatever reason, found myself awake close to midnight Wednesday night. And the episodes drop a little early, like sometimes 10 minutes before midnight, sometimes like, you know, a little bit earlier. And I've ended up watching each of them as they've dropped. And then, of course, I can't go to sleep right away because then I'm thinking about them and just, you know, geeking out. But I love it.
Yeah, I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
On a complex discovery project right now, so no, that's not happening. I'll watch it after work, after dinner.
Were I still in, like, you know, back in the school days, high school, college, whatever, we'd probably be doing watch parties at midnight, you know. But yeah. Those days are a little in the rearview mirror, so.
Yep, no thank you. That's irresponsible. Well, let's talk about not just what Gen Xers are doing in life, but let's get into the bigger issues from Star Trek Picard. And we see a lot of action on the Borg cube, which we're, you know, they call the artifact. And Hugh is the executive director of it. And we learn a lot about how Borg are treated in this new world. So we have possible discrimination issues. So former Borg, or reclaimed Borg, because that's one of the phrases that's used, that we are reclaiming them, is XBs. And I don't know if that's the letter X, letter B, or EX hyphen B, I don't know. But they're called XBs. And who says no more despised people in the galaxy than the XBs. That's big. He also highlighted some think that they are property to be exploited, others a hazard to be warehoused, and the Romulans see them as both. And we also see that Romulans who are XBs are really messed up. They're super, I think the word they used was distressed. You know, it looked like the inside of a mental health hospital. And again, we can get into the geek issue of we've had Vulcan mysticism and mind melds and Vulcans being able to do things on a deeper level. We haven't seen that with Romulans before, but apparently assimilating Romulans didn't go well, and that the Romulan ship that was assimilated was the last ship that Borg cube assimilated. So let's think about discrimination of XBs. What jumped out to you about this?
You know, so this is a multi-layered question, a multi-layered issue here, because discrimination in general, the way the laws are fashioned, you know, they are typically a restraint of some kind. Many of the laws in the United States, for example, we get back to the idea of a government of limited powers, which was a radical idea, you know, at the time that it was conceived and implemented. And so many of the Bill of Rights, the amendments, they're all seen as rights against the government, you know, rights that the government cannot infringe upon. The government can't search you, seize your property without just cause. Can't arrest you without reason, things like that. So then many of the discrimination laws are fashioned in a similar way, that government cannot discriminate against you, on the basis of certain protected classes, race, religion, you know, things like that, so on and so forth. And then that protection is then extended into, you know, through various ways, the Commerce Clause, et cetera, it's extended to private companies and actors, to prohibit discrimination against these protected classes. So one of the first questions regarding these XBs, and I mean, I would think that that would stand for X-Borgs or X-Borg drones, I suppose. The first question would be, well, really, what are they? You know, are they part of a protected class and therefore deserving of protection from discrimination arising, you know, as a result of who they are from other people, from governments or individuals or companies or whatnot? It's hard to say because I think if we look at all the Star Trek canon, the Borg are introduced in Q Who, that episode, second season of Star Trek: The Next Generation by Maurice Hurley and that creative team. The Borg really were developed far more later on in Next Gen. You know, the two-parters, Best of Both Worlds, and then also Descent, Hugh, I-Borg. But we get more development both in the movie First Contact and then also in Star Trek Voyager. You know, the Borg played a huge role there and even made an appearance in Star Trek Enterprise. The Borg have been here for a long time. But if you look at sort of the betrayal of the Borg and then what happens to people after they are assimilated, I think that's sort of an evolving concept. You know, the first person we know that really gets assimilated is Picard in Best of Both Worlds. And then once the implants are removed, he kind of goes back to being Picard like right away. And even before that, while Data is connected to him, Picard is able to talk to him, even though he is still arguably maybe assimilated, but he's able to reach out to Data. And he says, Data, sleep, Data, sleep. And he's giving Data some, advice on how to defeat the Borg. So Picard is able to recover from his assimilation, not without scars. I mean, at least he's, he heals on screen, but he seems to go back to being Picard at least. And then we see in some episodes of, for example, Star Trek Voyager, there was the one episode where a couple former Borg drones seek out Seven of Nine because they can't get each other out of their heads and they want to sever that connection, and they're able to do so. But they all look relatively, I won't say human, they're humanoid, different races, but they clearly look like they're not Borg anymore, even though they are still suffering those effects. So I guess the question is, are former Borg drones a protected class? Are they now just, do they go back to being a member of their original, race, their original species, or are they something different? And that's really hard to say. I think it's fair to say from the Star Trek canon that former Borg drones, they don't go back to being exactly who they were before. They've been altered, and you can't go back 100% the way you were before after undergoing such a traumatic experience. But who are they now? Are they still drone? Are they still Borg? Or are they, these innocent victims that were assimilated? And can they be discriminated against, because of things they did while they were Borg, or now, just because, okay, well, you're former Borg and I hate the Borg, they hurt me or my home, my loved ones, and so I hate you. These are all questions that are, I don't know if there's necessarily a right answer. We could try to break that down some, but what are your thoughts, Josh?
Well, Mix, it's, and to focus specifically, on, the public accommodation laws that exist or the civil rights acts that exist, the issue turns on race, color, national origin, sexual orientation, sex, and other factors that people can be discriminated upon. And that can also include disease. Medical condition, genetic anomalies. So, there's a lot there. And, somebody who's formally Borg doesn't fit into one of those categories easily. It could be a form of, say, disease, physical condition that happened to someone. because, you know, the story does get into the issue of like a common mythology or news that could happen for, you know, XBs to give them a common framework, even though theoretically they kind of do have a common framework because of what happened to them is a collective experience. There's also, you know, the Unimatrix Zero issue as well. So I do think we could craft the current civil rights laws that we have to apply to people who are former Borg, you know, and maybe, you know, even the term XB, itself discriminatory in nature because of the way it could, you know, cause a disparagement and you know, treatment that's not fair. Because at the end of the day, you know, the 14th Amendment, you know, is in trying to give people all persons equal protection under the law. And if you're not having equal protection under the law because of, you know, a POW experience that you had, that you're a kidnapping victim, putting the, you know, what the Borg experience could be comparable to is people taken against their wills. Yeah, that's a form of kidnapping. Now they're tortured. Medical experiments are performed upon them and implanted equipment into their bodies, all of which is highly invasive and traumatic. That starts giving physical characteristics and medical conditions that I think would qualify to for people to have you know, various civil rights claims if they were being treated differently, like not being offered jobs, you know, not being able to travel, not being able to go places or barred entry because they're a former Borg. Because, you know, again, if they're being viewed as property or as a biohazard, that's, you know, not okay. Like right now we have the issue of, forgive me if I mispronounce it, but, you know, the coronavirus. And, you know, you think back to SARS from, you know, years earlier.
Yeah, right.
Of, you know, how you quarantine a medical emergency.
Well, right.
There are specific rules on that. And one of the earliest civil rights cases was a late 19th century out of San Francisco, where nativist, racist officials in San Francisco were trying to quarantine people from China and just like, you know, saying like, oh, there are all these individuals are diseased, so we want to push them all off and keep them away from everyone else. And the court recognized this is pure racism, you know, plain, clean, and simple. Well, if you're doing that to people who were kidnapped and experimented on by the Borg, it's the same type of situation. So I do think that XBs could be a protected class.
We could certainly make the argument, and there are some good ones to make to try to get them that type of protection. You know, the scenario in which we're envisioning this, I think, is, you know, Borg is denied something that is considered a basic right, like, you know, refused service at a restaurant, for example, or refused entry to some place, refused passage on a plane, a ship, refused a job that they really wanted, and, you know, said, well, you know, we don't really like your kind around here, so why don't you, but, you know, to kind of leave. You know, in those situations, could a Borg sue? So that's one way to look at it. Another interesting point that's related to what we're talking about here, you know, if the Borg were ever to be prosecuted for horrors and atrocities that they committed while they were drones, and now they're no longer our drones, you know, they get away from the collective, they become individuals again, kind of like Seven of Nine, could they be prosecuted for some of the things they did? And, you know, it would really make for a very interesting, you know, not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect defense, you know, the insanity defense, essentially. You know, did they really know what they were doing? Possibly. But do they really have control over their actions? Arguably not. They're part of the collective. And as you pointed out, they all went that way unwillingly. They were fighting it and didn't want to be assimilated. That could really make for a fascinating, I think, legal exercise if we ever kind of went that route someday.
I did a blog post around the 50th anniversary of Star Trek on whether or not Starfleet officers assimilated by the Borg were collaborating POWs. And there's like no intent. They do have a really good insanity defense because they're completely violated by the process and their individuality, stripped away.
Absolutely.
So they're easy to defend for what happened, and prosecuting the Borg itself is somewhat difficult because putting the collective on trial, how do you do that?
Put the Queen on trial, I suppose. But yeah. I think the bottom line here is that can the Borg claim discrimination? Can they claim rights as a protected class? And I think the answer is possibly, very, very possibly. And who knows how the Supreme Court would rule on something like this. But a lot of the basic elements are there. But the law has not confronted something quite like this before. The closest would be, POWs or people who have been captured, seen as collaborating, and then they escape and try to return to their normal life. And, how do we see them, as a society? And then how do we see them under the law?
Yeah, and I don't think it'd be a POW, but more like, cult member.
Brainwashing.
You need the deprogramming, and we don't have a lot of cases on that. The cult cases, from like the 60s and 70s are weird and don't necessarily get to, the deeper issue of it, because courts frequently say that person had free will and agency. Just because they're obnoxious doesn't mean that they've lost their free will.
And it would be interesting to see on this show as it goes on, if there were to be a champion for the Borg, an advocate for them, I would think it would be Hugh, because, when we last see him in Next Generation, I think it's Riker who points out, you do have a leader. When Hugh says, we're leaderless, and they say, no, you do have a leader. You are their leader. And Hugh now has most of his implants removed. He still has the scars physically and presumably emotionally and whatnot. But he seems to be mentally there. His speech is not as slow as it was in, the Next Generation episodes. He seems to be thinking on his feet. And, who is more aware of the plight of former drones than Hugh? So I wonder if we'll get some kind of debate or discussion at one point where Hugh talks about the status of former Borg drones and, how they can be integrated, or can they be reintegrated into society? I don't know. Go ahead.
Well, it is the, Romulan reclamation site. So I think that is their intent. And while that is a very weird name, that does, have a specific connotation that they're reclaiming them.
Yeah.
They're not getting rid of them. That's not the Romulan elimination site. Because again, nuking it would have been an easy option for we're not keeping this around. Just push that into the oncoming supernova and we're getting the hell out of here.
Right. And your analogy earlier too, that the Romulans, who are who were assimilated and have gotten away, when we walk in there, it does look like one of those medical facilities where psychiatric patients are living, and they're a bit of a danger to themselves, so they're closely monitored. They are assisted with their living needs, not really independent, where some of, they have good days, they have bad days, but some of them are really just not there anymore because of this trauma. I think that analogy is very, very correct. It almost looks like some kind of psychiatric hospital, which in, we can go a lot of directions on that, but I have to say, and part of me wants, it feels like we need to give the Romulans a little bit of credit that at least they're trying to take care of their own people who were assimilated. Then there's, of course, the mystery too, like what happened to the Borg, you know, ship, the cube, as it tried to assimilate the Romulans, and why was there some systems failure? You know, is there something we're going to learn? Does this tie into that whole idea that's mentioned by Laris, that, you know, have you ever noticed the complete and utter absence of synthetic life in Romulan culture? You know, maybe it goes back to that. Maybe there's some ancient mythology here that's in play. But I think we're in store for some good storytelling.
Agreed there. You know, hopefully they don't wait too long, you know, that if they keep the mystery box a mystery for too long, you know, it can consume the storytelling.
Yes.
So hopefully that is resolved better than, say, the end of Discovery Season 2 was resolved.
It was an interesting way to tie up the threads, but we'll stay with Picard for now, I think.
Yeah, well, this has kept the same showrunner, so I'm feeling better about consistency.
Right.
And an overall message of where they're going. But, you know, like, I'm fine with not having a scientific answer, that things can be either mystical or mythical.
Sure.
You know, like, and again, if it ties into their issue, like, they don't like AI, and why? Also, why does, you know, the surviving sister suddenly know things?
Yeah, it's unusual. Yeah.
That makes me question whether or not Maddox was involved with her, or was Maddox used, because is she a Borg agent wanting to find out why the Submatrix failed?
You know, maybe. She there's so many possibilities.
Yeah, because it's just... And again, I like to avoid fan speculation, because it's easy for people to go off on massive tangents and just sound insane. So we're not going to do that here.
I will point out that as you say, it's really odd when we see Dodge and now, you know, Dodge and then now now this one, the other sister, Soji. There are two times when we see them sort of activate, if you will, or suddenly recall a lot. And it's when they talk to their mother, you know, and I'm using air quotes around that term. But Dodge, as you recall in the first episode, is sort of lost and then not sure where to go, talks to her mom, and her mom says, you got to go back to Picard. And suddenly Dodge kind of, it awakens these abilities, unlocks them apparently. And then she goes and looks for Picard. So, but for talking to her mother, she may not have gone that direction. And then in this third episode, Soji is talking to her mom and kind of catching up with her. Oh, is Dodge okay? And, oh yeah, of course. And, you know, she was just talking to me about getting a dog, and that seems to suddenly activate something now in Soji. So is this Bruce Maddox's way of kind of keeping them on task, or, you know, guiding their direction? Who knows? But there's something there.
There's something there. And, you know, if it is a plan put in motion by Maddox, is he trying to find a way to, you know, deliver another death blow to the Borg? Because, you know, yeah, this Borg cube, their submatrix failed after they assimilated some Romulans.
Yeah.
Okay. What did they encounter with the Romulan brain? And because we've seen Vulcans assimilated, you know, like Tuvok.
I think we have, yes. Yeah.
Tuvok was assimilated and had issues because he did like the order and the logic, that he was a little more susceptible to the pull of the collective.
Right.
That aside, is what's the intent here? And I don't know. I did find it interesting to see Romulan tarot cards.
Yes.
And that was something I liked about last season of Discovery, and then they like shied away from it, going like, oh, it's, I'm okay with a mystery not having a solid answer, mm-hmm. or, you know, the way that the motion picture ended with, you know, Decker and V'ger merging and...
Right.
You know, list them as missing. Like, I'm okay right. with that kind of ending. Like, it's okay to have mystery. It's okay for audiences to think things. Or, you know, again, I was thinking about, 2001, after listening to the latest Imaginary Worlds podcast, which talked about that. And again, it's okay for movies to ask questions or TV shows ask questions about, like, what's the meaning of life, what's happening here, and not get a straight answer because you're supposed to think about it. I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
That aside,
you know, parting thought on the XBs here. Mm-hmm. You know, when we're looking at the two times that we see the sisters communicate with their mother and they seem to reactivate, a lot of parallels there to the Manchurian Candidate, you know, where you have sort of a sleeper agent maybe getting off task, and then remember you play solitaire and suddenly, whoop, reactivates. There they go. You know, they're back again. I wonder if it's perhaps the parallels are intentional. I don't know, but it's an interesting thing to consider.
Yeah, it also raises issues with hot Romulans and unhealthy sibling relationships.
Right. Yeah.
I was like, this is creepy. If they're siblings, why are they talking like that? The future can't be that mellow.
It would rank up there with disturbing sibling relationships, although, you know, it probably still doesn't quite approach the Game of Thrones level, you know, the Lannisters. Jamie and Cersei, but oh well.
Yeah, intentional versus Carnival Row, which has unintentional, at least by one of the participants.
Right,
happy place. So. Let's go to happier subjects, you know, like the genocide on Mars, you know.
Yeah, very happy.
Let's break that thought with mass death. You know, we do go, you know, we have another flashback to Mars, you know, who allowed the attack. You know, we do have the theory from, that the Romulans could have been involved, and we did talk about that some. We do have flashbacks to Picard offering his resignation. And, you know, like, don't bluff like that. I mean, it's one thing to...
Yep.
I mean, that was a fair amount of hubris on his part to make.
Yes.
But do you really want to say, you're going to let millions of people die, so I'm out?
Yeah.
That's perfectly fine. You know, if he presented a logical argument and they said, no, we're comfortable letting millions of people die or billions of people die, and him to say, I'm done. Like, that's perfectly understandable.
Yeah.
But as a bluffing maneuver, that's a bad plan.
Yeah. They called him on it. Yeah. That was a poor hand of poker by our friend Picard, unfortunately.
Yeah. It's just, I'm all for going, we should save them. And if you can't save all of them, save as many as you can, because that's the moral issue of, you know, like what makes Star Trek, Star Trek, because going home to pout isn't a good solution.
Yeah.
Now we still don't know what his relationship was with, you know, Ambassador Spock and, you know, the attempt to use the red matter to save the Romulan Star Empire. So,
right.
Just because they voted it down, Vulcan didn't give up. So
yes, and it's interesting that Picard often is seen as the conscience, like our conscience on the show, and he, going back to some of the moments when Picard would give that lecture, as he does, for example, in Insurrection, you know, he lectures the admiral who's killed. You know, who the hell are we, excuse my language, to determine the future of these people? You know, that's not our right. And then as Picard says to his good friend, Kirsten Clancy, CNC of Starfleet, we do not get to decide who lives or dies. And she responds, well, yes, we do. And I mean, she's right in a sense, like practically speaking, yeah, they do. You know, Picard's more saying we shouldn't get to decide who lives or dies. But we see early on then, and this is many years before the show starts, Starfleet's no longer, as Picard said, Starfleet's no longer Starfleet. It's not the Federation that we remember. And I mean, what happened is you had a 9/11 type of event, you know, the destruction of Utopia Planitia. And unlike 9/11 in, you know, our world, in the Star Trek world, it looks like you had the equivalent of some sort of huge, massive attack, tremendous destruction, tremendous loss of life. However, you know, Starfleet didn't really have someone they could target in retaliation. The synthetics, at least the one synthetic we saw, killed himself. We don't know if the Federation was able to hunt down the people that attacked, you know, Utopia Planitia. There's been no mention of that, but it's possible they did, but it seems that the synthetics may have all just self-destructed too after they completed this, you know, this destructive mission. It's really odd. So we're left without some closure there. Perhaps we'll find out more. I don't know.
Possibly, you know, but it still goes against human nature that after disaster to see a complete abandonment of values.
Yes.
When, because again, that's literally not humanity. And we can always point to like, oh, people are horrible. Not always. And the majority of people are good. Now, after 9/11, you know, there was outpouring from other countries, including people who used to be our enemies, with, we stand with you, because they saw the carnage and they went, this is unacceptable. I remember reading one instance of a German warship, you know, kind of coming alongside an American warship, and they opened up a banner that said, we stand with you. Mm. And we generally are the good guys.
Yeah.
People go help.
Right. And that Starfleet's the good guys usually.
Yeah. So seeing that, you know, it's one thing to say we can't. It's another thing to say we're just going to let you die. And that seemed counterintuitive. So.
Well, I would point out that, and yes, point well taken, but I would also observe that throughout history, a tremendous tragedy often can be used to justify things that pre-tragedy were unfathomable or at least unlikely. You know, after Pearl Harbor, you know, we had the internment of Japanese Americans. Would have been difficult to imagine that before Pearl Harbor, but it happened. And then I recall during 9/11, I was in school at the time. And at the time there was, you know, there had been some terrorist actions by fundamentalists, some Middle Eastern terrorists. And so there was some outcry in, you know, certain quarters about, well, we need to do something about that and go after quote unquote people like that. But it never got too far off the ground, thankfully. And then 9/11 happened, and all of a sudden that chorus of voices gained more traction because there was a lot more fear. And I remember thinking, okay, it is easy to judge in hindsight 50, 60 years after World War II and think, well, how could Japanese internment have ever occurred? But after 9/11, I found it far more easy to believe that we could see something like that happen again. And, you know, hopefully we learn the lessons of history, but you can understand that the climate has become such where something like that would not, while still unlikely, given that we have hopefully learned the lessons of history, one could see how it could occur and how it did occur in the first place. So, I mean, we really learn a lot about ourselves, you know, in the face of tragedy.
There's a lot to unpack there. So thinking about the internment of the Japanese, well, we did do that once before during World War I. We had camps for Germans during the First World War, and, you know, kind of forget that. And the fact that there were people of German ancestry who changed their names to sound less German.
Yes.
Because there was a great denunciation of German history in this country. Fast forward. There's always the exploitive reaction. You know, we needed new laws in order to deal with the national security concerns from like CIA and FBI not talking to each other. But the fact that the Patriot Act was ready to go so quickly is terrifying on multiple levels.
Right.
It's like, that's a big law. I mean, there are parts of it that are good, and there are parts of it that are not good. So again, they're there, and again, 20 years later, you know, we should be looking at what do we need still and what don't we need, which again, it's like authorization to use force. Now, the idea of renewing that every 3 years, probably not a bad idea. Congress should look at that sort of thing. But we're getting a little off track. But let's pivot back to some of the things that we do see in the episode. So when Picard actually meets Captain Rios, I hope I'm saying that correctly, he has both a EMH, so the emergency medical hologram, and an ENH, which would be navigation hologram. Yep. And the navigation version was clearly the Picard fanboy who represented every Star Trek fan ever and just listing all of the wonderful things that Picard had done. And I that was cute. I appreciated that. And Rios does have his share of PTSD from whatever happened on the heavy cruiser he was assigned to and how his last captain died. So, but it's interesting to see him as a kind of a merchantman, you know, borderline privateer. But the ship is clearly very Starfleet. You know, it's not like Han Solo in a very bachelor pad Millennium Falcon. This thing is ship's shape and tidy. And there's a lot to be said for that.
It's very Starfleet, as Picard points out.
And it was, I enjoyed Picard looking at the captain's chair.
Yeah, but not sitting in it.
Not sitting in it, which was the kind of the same that, you know, Kirk did in Generations.
Yes, the longing, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, that's where I belong. So I did enjoy that. We do have the attempted murder of Picard. So, and we texted about this. And for those listening, yes, we are that nerdy that after watching these, we do text back and forth about you know, just as all, we also have a Discord channel where we do that too. Because there's lots of lawyers and we think about this stuff. But, you know, in meeting with the captain, let's go back. You know, we have Rios does make a comment about you're not planning to do anything illegal. And Picard saying, I'm not in the habit of consulting lawyers before doing what needs to be done. It's like, you know what? We'd find a way to make it work, dude. Don't think of lawyers as just being the guys to say no. Think of us as finding the way to make it work. And there could be ways to go mount a rescue mission. So again, that was kind of fun.
But yeah.
We then get, we learn about Picard's home security. And the Second Amendment fans out there would be proud to know that they do have a bunch of phasers scattered around the house, you know, being prepared for an attack. Because if you're an admiral, you probably do have a big target on your back. Picard probably has a long list of people that do want him dead. So that makes sense that the house would have a very good security system.
I was wondering about security at the Vineyard. And did they pull out their own phasers to fight these Romulans? Because I thought they were I thought they were physically beating them and then taking their own disruptors and using them against them.
There was like, you know, ones under desks and under tables that were wrong. So it's like the spy house. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense with, you know, when your housemates are former Tel Shiar. And you know, if you do think you have a target on you, you're probably going to have some security.
Yeah, if that's correct, then, if they were using a lot of Federation phasers, assuming they weren't using Romulan weapons that Laris and her husband brought. But if they were using Federation weapons, they should have been. They typically would have been set to stun, and if so, they probably should have had more than one prisoner, because I was left with the impression, at least, that they only had one live prisoner that could still talk.
Yeah, that was my reaction as well. I think that was the guy who was, I think he was stunned. I mean, I would need to watch the fight.
Yeah.
But there were, the fight did include Romulan weapons being used after they were disarmed by Picard. Like, he did use his cane on one of them.
Yes.
Again, it's nice to see, the 92-year-old,
get off my lawn.
Yeah. I mean, I frequently think of Up,
Mr. Fredrickson. Yeah.
It's like, grandpa's old for a reason.
Yeah. Don't mess with them. Yeah.
There's a reason why there aren't a lot of them left. And he had better survival tactics than the others. So, so I think that's a factor, in the story. But I mean, that's attempted murder. I mean, it's a full-on home invasion attempted murder.
I mean, obviously a lot of laws being violated there by the Romulans, but this is some sort of, subversive undercover hit, like a black ops mission or some ninja like assassination attempt on Picard and I guess whoever else that may get in their way. Yeah, I want to point back some of the connective tissue here. Commodore O, who made a memorable appearance in episode 2, makes a very brief appearance in episode 3. It literally appears for one scene, I would say, I don't know, maybe 5 seconds, two lines, introduces herself and then says, I want to talk to you about your conversations with Picard. But wow, she is memorable and leaves just a tremendous impression on the story. Tamlin Tamita is doing an amazing job, and she is a fascinating character. I went from thinking that she was probably part Romulan or some sort of Romulan agent to now thinking that the more interesting character study would be if she were just Vulcan and believes that logic dictates that she should help the Romulans on this point because it is in the best interests of Starfleet somehow. That could be.
Well, we've a lot to unpack there. So a couple things. One, that is one intense looking woman wearing sunglasses, and I wouldn't want to be on her bad side. So yeah, I'd be scared if she snuck up on me.
I don't think I want to mess with her. Yeah.
Nope. Now, I know your wife could take her, but...
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah, nope. Gonna let her handle that. So there's that. But we've seen Vulcans go bad before. We had Polaris, in Star Trek VI.
Yeah.
Who collaborated. And... Discovery made mention to logic fanatics existing on Vulcan.
Right.
So, and to the point of not wanting Vulcans and humans to interbreed.
Yes, there were the isolationists, the people who despised Sarek for taking a human wife. And, there were Vulcans that believed we should withdraw from the galaxy because we're the best, we're the smartest. Why do we need to consort with these inferior beings?
Which it doesn't sound logical, that aside. So interesting questions with her. And then we have Agnes showing up during the fight at just the right time, and I have very mixed feelings on this. The fact that she said she's a terrible liar, I don't know if that means she is or not.
That's right. She did say that, didn't she? She's a terrible liar.
And she looks traumatized. I think hand shaking. I mean, she does look like someone who was like completely freaked out. Like they just went through. I work in an office. I'm not used to seeing this.
And how fortuitous is her timing? She just happens to show up at the exact right time.
And so, reasons that she could be on the up and up. you know, she met with O, or O dropped in on her. O decided to take action, and the Romulan hit squad goes to take out Picard.
Yep.
Agnes, being a good human being, after talking to O, thinks, I'm going to beam to the other side of the planet and go warn Picard. And thus, she arrives at the same time because similar reasons. So that coincidence I could find probable. But the timing is suspect. Some of the things that she says are suspect. However, the fact she is so adorable, and you throw in the how traumatized she looks, that does support her not being compromised in some way, that she's like not acting under a Vulcan mind meld. But I don't know. You know, this is a Star Trek TV show. It could go either way.
Yeah, there's... Yeah. I mean, Jurati's a very likable character, and she, you know, you get the feeling that she's very much over her head, in over her head, and that she's not the one that runs out, grabs weapons, and blasts the enemy, and, you know, goes on these crazy missions and deep into, you know, the unknown. She's the one that stays back in the safety of the lab and kind of does her research and supports the people who may be on the front lines, but is not a field agent. And now she is suddenly a field agent, and wow, what is she doing? You know, she's saving Picard, apparently, and the Earth's foremost expert on cybernetics, and until they find, presumably, Bruce Maddox at some point. So,
again, you would go save Grandpa. I'd go save Grandpa. Like, that isn't... And you know what? He would have wine handy, because we'd be freaked out. We're lawyers.
Yeah.
We are not action heroes. We're lawyers.
Action of a different kind, I would say, right?
Yeah. We have suit and tie collections.
Yeah. We can craft arguments and legal analyses, you know, just like the Tal Shiar can dodge and, you know, fire weapons, but yeah.
Yeah, you know, we're not the guys you call for that. That's Thomas Harper's department.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's Jurati is very interesting. You know, how impactful would that be for us to get to the end of the season and find out that she is a sleeper agent, or that she's collaborating with O and the Zod Vash somehow, or either knowingly or unknowingly. I don't know. That would be very interesting.
I'm sure we'll find out in the weeks ahead. But until then, here's the thing. I hope not, because I want her back in season two, because she is adorable.
Yeah, she's great. Yeah, yeah, she's
just fun. And
she's like the every person, you know, mm-hmm. that through which we're seeing all of this. Like, oh, you know, a lot of people know that person that works in the lab, and you know, now we're traveling with her. We're kind of like, okay, she's a point of view character for us.
Indeed she is. So I like all the characters, and you know, they're different. Star Trek does a very nice job putting together the ensemble cast that represents different facets of society.
Yeah.
Of life. And this time around, we're getting people who one with lots of PTSD, another who feels very betrayed and sought a form of recreational drugs.
We haven't talked a lot about Raffi.
Yeah.
We did a little bit last podcast, but I wanted to point out, and I mean, this is very obvious, but how different is Picard's crew this time from the last time we saw him, you know, in Next Generation and in the last outing in Star Trek Nemesis? You know, he's usually got the best and the brightest and the people who are out to just do good, you know, common cause, common purpose. But this time, it really is far more of a ragtag group, like a motley crew of people, all of whom are, you know, damaged or haunted or, you know, flawed deeply. And they're all out. They all have their demons. They have all got an axe to grind with Starfleet. I think Girardi would probably be arguably the most, I guess, for lack of a better term, well-adjusted person out of all of them. Her tragedy, I guess, is that she can't do her work anymore, the work that she loves, because it's been essentially shut down by Starfleet. But yeah, you've got Rafi who breaks down crying when she talks about losing her security clearance, like the work she loves so much, and she's turned to recreational drugs. Captain Rios, something happened, in his former ship and his former commander, right? Picard, we know about. I mean, he turned his back on Starfleet because he felt Starfleet turned its back, on the Romulans. Very interesting approach. It's not so much the Star Trekian approach to our point of view crew, because our point of view crew, sure, they'll all have flaws and they can get hurt over the series, but they don't usually have emotional scars of this level, right?
Part of it is, it's a different reflection of society. Star Trek in the 1960s, it was 20 years after World War II, right. And there was a greater sense of optimism in the United States at that time.
Sure.
Star Trek The Next Generation in the 1980s, again, it was latter half of the Reagan administration. There was a lot of optimism in the country, and like that makes sense. You throw in Deep Space Nine and Voyager, and Deep Space Nine really gets into PTSD, yeah. and other demons. And one friend, Matt Weinhold, once described, and I don't remember who Matt was quoting, but a wonderful quote about, Star Trek the Next Generation is what we wanted to be. Deep Space Nine is what we are.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
That quote is accurate.
Yeah. There's the aspirational, what we want to be, but the reality, the two don't always intersect.
And having, like if everything was hunky-dory and everyone was flying high, there's not a lot of storytelling there.
No, not at all, right?
Yeah, it's like, don't worry, everybody, everything's A-okay.
Yeah.
It's like, well, there's nothing to overcome. There's no growth. And so seeing individuals who have suffered, who've gone through experiences that hurt them, and seeing them go like, hey, something bad's happening, and I'm going to figure out a way to make it better, to stop that thing from happening. We want to see people rise up. We want to see people, respond to the better angels of their nature. And in, the ENH, talks about, Picard being on the side of the angels.
Right.
So, it's that aspirational goal of, Grandpa remembered who he is, and then decided that it's time to take action because my best friend technically has two kids, one died, and well, damn it, I'm going to go out and do something about it.
It is a far different crew than we've ever seen before.
And I'm okay with that. One of the reasons why, Search for Spock is one of my favorite Star Trek movies is, it's easy to say the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the fewer of the one. But when everyone goes like, we're going to go save our buddy, whatever the consequences, we're going to go save him. It's kind of similar to what we're seeing in Picard with, my friend has a kid. She's in danger. I'm going to cowboy up and put together some folks and we're going to go do that.
Right.
I like that. And as an attorney, I'd find ways to make sure all the paperwork is done correctly.
It would be our honor to defend people who are doing the right thing.
Yeah, as opposed to... Oops, I drove through the stoplight, or oh no, the brakes don't work on this model car. It's like one of those cases. Actually, not that I deal with those, but the idea, that's what there's the what lawyers dream of doing when you're in law school, and then there's the cases that you actually do get. And for those that you are representing, you know, like they matter, you know, like most small businesses can't take like a $200,000 hit, like they're done. Another friend had just worked on a lawsuit where like there were trade secrets involved, and it was a situation that like if they lost, like people are out of business and hundreds of people lose their jobs.
Yeah, bet the company, right.
Yeah. And like those cases are important, radically important. It's like if you made sure that several hundred people still were employed, God bless you. But we all don't get those. And so, you know, when you're given the opportunity to go like, oh, we could go actually help someone, yeah, we'll make that work.
We're back to the paradigm we mentioned earlier, the aspirational, what we want it to be versus the reality of what it is, right? And when the two meet, that's great. But, you know, more often than not, they do not meet. And what do you do?
Yeah, there's, again, there's the day in, day out. But when you have the opportunity, I'm like, yeah, every case is important. I'm like, that goes without saying. You know, it's people's lives.
Yeah.
However, some, you know, will have a greater impact than just crunching numbers or IP rights or things of that nature. When it comes down to, you know, can you make a difference? Can you actually help someone? And that's one of the beauties of Star Trek, because you see characters go, yeah, let's go do the right thing. As opposed to, I'll just tend to my grapes and not worry about it. So I think I'm loving this, and I'm grateful to live in a world where we have live action Star Trek again.
Yeah, it's been too long. Yeah.
Well, that, and we'll soon have animated Star Trek.
Yes, Lower Decks. Done by the same people who did the Lego Ninjago cartoon, which is a fabulous, you know, fantastic storytelling show that I watch with my kids. And I'm constantly amazed at the storytelling, the character development. And I keep telling them, this is a great show. It doesn't talk down to you. It actually ups the level of storytelling and characters, deep characters, good guys doing bad things, bad guys doing good things. You know, really impressive. So I'm hopeful for Lower Decks.
We'll find out soon enough. And but until then, we get Picard. We'll also soon have Clone Wars. But, you know, one nerdy TV show at a time.
So, yeah, it's a golden age for us.
It's just, why are all the Gen X guys hugging and crying? You know? Daddy, what's wrong? It's beautiful.
It is. Yeah, it's wonderful.
Good time to be a nerd. So with that, well, stay tuned. We'll see what the next episode brings and whether or not Solchi is the destroyer and what caused the submatrix to collapse and, you know, how to go vindicate the rights of those who suffered at the hands of the Borg. Or circuits of the Borg. So with that...
As Mr. Spock is always fond of saying, there are always possibilities.
Yes, there are. So with that, everyone, stay geeky, America.